supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Democrats hoping to take back majorities in Congress see an opportunity in South Jersey. They're hoping to flip a seat that's been in Republican control since 1994. But first, voters will have to make a decision among Democrats in Tuesday's primary. And as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the race is pitting Democratic leadership against the party's more progressive wing.
Good morning. How are you? I'm Tansy Youngblood. I'm running for Congress. Yeah, Youngblood. Did you hear about me?
Tansy Youngblood is ignoring the sweat dripping down her face. She's busy knocking on doors on a muggy Saturday morning. We're at the Amity Heights Apartments in Bridgeton, a South Jersey city of about 25,000 people an hour's drive from Philadelphia. The city is mostly Black and Hispanic, and a third of its residents live in poverty.
Because you know what? This is what I got in this race for. I got in this race to help communities like this. Excuse me. Hi. Can I see 1 minute?
Youngblood is a retired school teacher. She's running for Congress in the state's 2nd District, which stretches from just outside Philly across thousands of acres of farmland to Atlantic City and the Jersey Shore. For the past 24 years, it's been represented by Republican Frank Lobiondo. In 1994, Lobiondo rode the same conservative wave that launched Newt Gingrich into the House speakership. The South Jersey Republican has fended off Democratic challengers ever since. But Youngblood says residents in places like Bridgeton haven't seen their lives improve during Lobiondo's tenure.
Now, when you look at that area we just came from, what has he done for those people in that area?
Youngblood had already started campaigning last year when Lobiondo announced he was retiring, explaining that it was time to move on. That's when the Democratic field got more crowded. Dentist and New Jersey State Senator Jeff Van Drew, who's been in the legislature since 2002, decided to make the jump to federal politics. Almost immediately, Van Drew became the presumptive frontrunner.
He's got a track record that people know.
Michael Klein studies public policy at Stockton University.
He's a quintessential retail politician. He's at every event you could think of. He's a known quantity.
Van Drew has the backing of national Democrats, and perhaps most importantly, all 8 county parties in the district have endorsed him, which means Van Drew gets what's called the county line on the ballot in Tuesday's primary. He'll be all the way to the left with the other endorsed Democrats, like U.S. Senator Bob Menendez. As for Youngblood, she and the 2 other Democratic candidates in the race will be off to the right.
It's a place of prominence. It's where people's eyes go as they walk into the voting booth, and that is very significant.
Democratic leadership may be behind Van Drew, but members of the party's more progressive wing think he's too conservative. For example, he voted against same-sex marriage. His campaign wasn't able to fulfill our request for an interview, but here's how Van Drew responded to that criticism in an appearance on NJTV.
It is important to work for your country and not always for your political party. So I'm a Democrat, but if I really truly believe there's a good Republican idea, I would vote for it and support it.
One of the things progressives dislike most about Van Drew is his stance on guns. Van Drew supports the Second Amendment and reportedly has a few guns of his own. At a public forum in February, the Philadelphia Inquirer captured the moment 17-year-old Emily McGrath challenged Van Drew on a contribution he took from the NRA in 2011.
They gave you $1,000 in 2011 in the primary.
Never,
what do you say about that?
He's also voted against several gun control bills in the state legislature, votes that have earned him a 100% rating from the NRA. Van Drew says he's an independent thinker and points to a host of Democratic issues he's voted for, like medical marijuana and funding for women's health care. His critics say the race comes down to one question. Why do leaders in the Democratic Party support somebody like Van Drew over more progressive candidates like Youngblood, who supports gun control and same-sex marriage? Van Drew's supporters say it's because he's the most electable candidate. He's raised 6 times more money than Youngblood, who's 2nd in the race in fundraising. Van Drew has also attracted substantial outside spending. And he's got broad support from Democratic leaders in South Jersey, like behind-the-scenes power broker George Norcross. But Tansy Youngblood says it's that kind of top-down politics that's making Democratic voters disillusioned. And she thinks it's the same kind of disillusionment that caused voters in the 2nd District who went for Barack Obama twice to vote for Donald Trump in 2016.
That's what the Democratic establishment doesn't get. That same group of voters, the Trump voters, are going to be my voters. Those I call them change voters. That's what I call them. They're the change voters.
Frank Lobiondo's retirement means change is coming to the 2nd District. On the Republican side, there are a handful of candidates, but no frontrunner. But for Democrats who want to flip the seat, voters will first have to decide what kind of change they want to see. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Let's expand our primary election focus beyond the Democratic race in the 2nd Congressional District with Colleen O'Day with New Jersey Spotlight. Colleen, thanks for joining us again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Colleen, take us right to the top, the statewide race featuring incumbent U.S. Senator Bob Menendez.
Primary-wise, there's not a heck of a lot happening either on the Democratic side, where, of course, Menendez is running, or on the Republican side, where it's expected that Bob Hugin, a former Celgene Pharmaceuticals executive, is going to win. Hugin is spending big bucks. He's already loaned his campaign $7.5 million. He has vowed to spend $20 million over the course of the campaign. He has a primary opponent in Brian Goldberg, who is a conservative but has very little money. And Menendez has an opponent in Lisa McCormick, who is a publishing executive, and she's hasn't filed papers, but she's said she has very little money. So it's hard in New Jersey, because we're sandwiched between Philadelphia and New York, to get your message out without a lot of money, without spending in the New York and Philly media markets. It's also hard to beat an incumbent. So the expectation is that Menendez versus Hugin in November is going to be what we have Senate-wise.
To what extent might Menendez be a compromised incumbent candidate to the extent that he has now gotten past his political troubles?
Well, it does seem like he is going to have a tougher time than even folks were saying a month ago. There was a Fairleigh Dickinson University poll out last week showing that Menendez has only a 4-point lead over Hugin. A month earlier, back in April, Menendez had a double-digit lead. Now, in the interim, Hugin has been spending that money that he's put into his campaign on lots of ads. He's running 3 ads, I think, at the moment, and 2 of the 3 are negative against Menendez. And you really wouldn't know from just looking at the ads that, in fact, Menendez was not convicted of the ethics violations that he was accused of. It seems like those ads may have hurt Menendez.
This is the largest field of candidates in a long time in New Jersey. Why?
Just because of the all of the interest that happened post 2016's election. We've had groups crop up all over the state, swing left groups, indivisible groups. Predominantly, they're progressive groups of folks that are trying to flip districts. And we've got a few in New Jersey that are either likely or potentially going to flip from red to blue this year. The 11th up in North Jersey is one that is an open seat now. The House Appropriations Chair, Rodney Frelinghuysen, Republican, longtime serving member of the House, decided to retire. He's been under attack incessantly by these groups. So there's going to be an open seat there, and that's one that could swing. The 7th is another just south of the 11th. Leonard Lance is the incumbent. That's another one that potentially could flip. And the one that's considered likely to flip is down in the 2nd District, where Jeff Van Drew is considered, I think, the likely Democratic nominee to replace Frank Lobiondo, who also retired, or is retiring at the end of this term.
Take us next to the neighboring 3rd District in South Jersey.
well, there's not a real reason to vote in this one just because there's no challenge on either side. So what it looks like is that Tom MacArthur, who is the incumbent Republican, is going to face Democrat Andy Kim in the fall. Again, neither has a primary opponent. MacArthur is one who has been pretty loyal to the president, and it does not seem to be hurting him. So MacArthur seems like he's in pretty good shape, and Andy Kim is raising a respectable amount of money, so that should be an interesting race.
As you bring up money again and again, can we take away that money matters even more than message?
Sadly, it seems that that may be the case. If you look at the Senate race, at least to date, Bob Huggins' ads, again, are very, he's got one ad saying who he is, and he's got two ads that are very negative against Menendez. He's really not said anything about what he plans to do. You know, he's talked sort of broadly about ideas he supports, but there have been no concrete proposals yet there. So it does seem like money often, you know, money can help you get your message out. Hopefully you do have a message to get out.
Thanks, Colleen.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Colleen O'Day with NJ Spotlight. In Delaware, traditional public schools are offering unique programs to entice students to come there. They're doing it to keep students from leaving for specialized charter or magnet schools. WHYY's Chris Barish tells us about one course that aims to get students to see the future.
Jeremy Nolan and classmate Ian Shotwell are at the controls inside Dickinson High School, maneuvering an Erector Set-like machine around an obstacle course. The boys aren't just playing with a toy. They're practicing for a competition on a motorized device they build in class. Welcome to Dickinson's Robotics Laboratory. It's where aspiring techies like Nolan learn and utilize engineering and software skills to bring their creations to life.
We like to call this room the fish tank. It's really a magnet for our school.
Other Delaware schools have robotics clubs, but for the last 8 years, Dickinson has had an official curriculum. The program continues attracting kids to the school near Pike Creek that had to disband its once proud football team last fall because there weren't enough players.
Well, robotics has always been something I'm more interested in because I enjoy the technology and the building aspect of things, and I figured it'd be a great path into computer programming because I was going to pursue computer science, but I decided later on in the program to switch to more robotics-oriented field.
Beyond spurring kids to a career in robotics, the program is helping to stabilize the school's declining enrollment. Today, about 100 of Dickinson's 600 kids take a robotics class, says teacher Sean Bowser.
They take robotics to help them with other things, like auto mechanics, or engineering, or architecture. And that's the nice thing about robotics. Robotics is all-inclusive. It encompasses the science, the math, the engineering, and the computer programming, all in one nice, neat little package.
The course teaches kids basic and advanced skills needed to design, build, operate and repair robots for use in the home, industry, even outer space.
I love getting these kids involved, getting them to thinking, getting them to see the future. It's not just about a program here. It's about their future now. It's about their career. It's about going to college.
Dickinson teams have won state contests and competed nationally. Nolan and other students have won scholarship awards to Capital Technology University in Maryland. Not all robotics students are eyeing a tech career. Junior Azaria Whitaker aspires to be a psychologist, but says the course has helped her anyway.
It's really good math-wise, and then also I'm not really good at building stuff, so it's really helping me to be more, I don't know how to explain it, like more open to building a lot of other things, because usually I wouldn't be like, oh no, I can't do that, I don't know what that is.
Bowser says testimonials like that are just what the school and the robotics program needs.
For Dickinson, I think it means the world. We're still slowly transitioning into what our school's really meant to be. This is definitely preparing you for the future.
Robotics is opening the eyes of Dickinson students, but whether this program and other specialized ones can ultimately save schools like it remains to be seen. Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Many cities tout their importance in the pantheon of American music, but it's hard to dispute the depth and range of Philadelphia's. On Saturday, guitarist Nels Klein will offer his homage to Philly's storied music history with Lovers for Philadelphia. It's a suite of music written by almost a century of Philadelphia jazz musicians. It's a new addition to his 2016 work, Lovers, a sprawling 2-CD set of jazz standards and great American songbook tunes interpreted for his guitar and 21 musicians. Nels Klein spoke about the project with Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas.
Let's start with the original Lovers project. Can you describe the parameters that you set for yourself, Nels?
It's something that I was thinking about in the late 80s at first. My initial intention was to do my own sort of personal updating or what I was seeing as a darker and possibly more thorough or honest version of a romance, atmospheric romance type record relating to the jazz idiom. And I thought it would be interesting to make a record in that style that was a jazz guitar kind of version of it, and one that contained sort of, I guess, some, you know, pretty or lush content, but also some darker and, I guess you might say, edgier and freer, structurally freer content. It was never intended to be a double album, but 20-some years went by and the song list sort of expanded over time. And I sort of kept a running list of these song ideas and wrote some original pieces. I kept putting off working on it because I was convinced that I really wasn't going to be able to pull off a masterful arrangement of these various songs. So that's how it all came together.
You said the darker side of some of these tunes, and we think of them more as like very lush and very emotional, Jerome Kern and Richard Rodgers. But in the essay you wrote to go along with this concert, you said the purpose was celebrating and challenging our iconic notion of romance. Challenging, I guess, would be addressing that dark side.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a song like Beautiful Love is beautiful, and a song like Secret Love is beautiful, and although I changed Secret Love considerably by adding this sort of polychord heartbeat pattern in a polyrhythm. But the darker elements don't come in with those pieces. For me, they come in with the inclusion of the Annette Peacock pieces, of the theme from The Night Porter, and Cry Want by Jimmy Giuffre. These pieces were always originally in my conception of this record. And the record over time didn't just expand in length, but it also got a little brighter than my initial conception. I don't know why that is exactly. I'm older now. I'm much older. Maybe I'm happier. I don't know. But I did want to have that sort of broader spectrum of sonic and emotional content.
So did you take the same approach for Lovers for Philadelphia?
I tried to, actually. It was much more difficult because I wasn't ever thinking of adding repertoire to Lovers. This was all Mark Chrisman at Ars Nova's idea. So, yeah, I was trying to bear in mind my own personal aesthetic concerns and conceptual ideas while also expanding my consciousness and delving into Philadelphian songbook, as it were.
Can you talk a little bit about the research work you did for this project? I know you've been in coming to Philadelphia for at least over a year.
The research was really interesting, actually, delving into a lot of the cultural institutions, going to the Curtis Institute and the Fleischer Institute and the Wagner Free Science Museum and the Free Library and seeing the Barnes Collection, going to the Philadelphia Museum of Art and seeing the Duchamp rooms. We hung out in the Sun Ra House. Fortunately, I had played with Marshall Allen a few months ago, and so it didn't feel totally like this foist. having this dude come over and to sit around in the Sun Ra house. But this was very important to me to see where all that music has been going on for so long. So I hung out with Marshall and Danny Thompson, and that was, you know, lovely. And, you know, went to see the newer Clef Club and just a lot of different things. It definitely was enabling me to sort of build up or accrue this idea of Philadelphia.
You've covered almost a century of Philadelphia music. You go back to Eddie Lang in like the 20s, right up to Uri Caine, who's active today on our scene.
Oh man, thank goodness that Uri Caine wrote a song called The Magic of Her Nearness, which I was not aware of, because I kept thinking Uri being this master genius person. I heard this piece as a solo piano piece, very Paul Blay influenced, and I'm a Paul Blay fanatic, so I was just practically jumping up and down with glee. We're going to do it very sparsely to kind of maybe keep in mind that it was originally a solo piano piece, but it will be subtly orchestrated as it progresses. But I wasn't able to address, for example, Pete Cosey or Charlie Ellerbe or Jamaluddin Takuma or Art Philly International. I'm not doing any Bardo Pond covers, so, you know, indie psych rock isn't getting represented, but we can't do it all.
Well, Nels Klein, thanks very much for talking with us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you, Kimberly. It's been a pleasure.
Nels Klein will perform Lovers for Philadelphia at Union Transfer on Saturday night.
Nels Klein spoke with Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is also produced by Shai Ben Yaakov and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.